This is the son of PCJ.
This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands and Antilles, directed from New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette Macquarie and Keith Perron.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us again for the monthly edition of the program. Coming up today, we will hear about how radio is bringing change to Rwanda, where an estimated 800,000 were killed in the Rwandan genocide in 1994.
Since the death of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il on December 17th, the eyes of the world have been paying close attention to the reclusive state. We'll have a closer look at how media functions from Pyongyang.
A few weeks ago, a movement called Connect St. Helena started. We'll hear from the guy who is leading this campaign.
This and more follows. Media Network Plus, the show that electrifies you. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
The Japanese government is running a rather original project against piracy on the internet. It is releasing two popular file-sharing networks between the 23rd and 29th of January, a series of files made to look like popular TV drama videos, but which will make a big surprise to the unsuspecting user. Named after some popular TV programs, the files, when opened, are alerting users of popular file-sharing networks Winnie and Share to stop handling pirated media on the web. The message is that both uploading and downloading copyrighted protected media is illegal in Japan. The initiative belongs to Japan's Ministry of Internal Affairs and Communications and is supposed to trace the future behavior of users who download the fake TV shows. It is yet unclear if any users caught in the act will be prosecuted. According to the Japanese press, about 150,000 people in the country are using the networks Winnie and Share every day. The BBC has announced an extension of its deal with SFR across its satellite and fiber networks. The award-winning international news and information channel is now available on SFR Satellite 9 Box. Formerly included in the package Le Boutique Selection, BBC World News became available last month on 9 Box. Following this deal, it means that BBC News 24 will reach more than 16 million homes across France. A 10-year tax holiday, duty exemptions, and the granting of infrastructure status are among the proposals reportedly being considered by the Indian broadcasting industry by the government. Reported RapidTVNews.com. The Information and Broadcasting Ministry is considering demands for support from the cable industry after it introduced legislation requiring the digitization of India's vast cable TV network. According to the Hindustan Times, in addition to an extended tax holiday under Section 81A of the Income Tax Act to help offset the cost of introducing new broadcasting technology, cable operators may be granted infrastructure status in the same way as the telecommunications sector. Around 68 million set-top boxes are expected to be required to support the nationwide digitalization of India's cable networks. The Vatican's news website is getting between 8,000 and 10,000 hits a day, with peaks up to 16,000 hits over the Christmas period. The website, which brings together all the Vatican's official communications and news from the Catholic Church around the world, was launched in June. The data was announced by Archbishop Claudio Maria Cerelli, head of the Pontiff Council for Social Communications, at the Vatican press conference. The Archbishop said the average time visitors spend on the websites in English, Italian, and Spanish was around 2 minutes, which he said showed those consulting it were not doing so by mistake, but were reading some of its content. Almost a third of visitors, 27%, were from the United States, followed by browsers from Italy, Germany, and Spain. There were also many visitors from Canada, Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina. He added most of the visits to the website were through social media networks, with 65% from Facebook and 30% from Twitter. And finally, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is launching an exclusive TV show, The World Tomorrow, which we broadcast on Russia Today. The show, which will begin in March, will be a series of 10 26-minute talk shows. Russia Today, in its press release, said Julian Assange, the project creator and host of the program, will meet with politicians, revolutionaries, all those, in his opinion, will be shaping the future. If you want more information about these and other stories, I invite you to check out the Media Network blog from Radio Netherlands Worldwide, produced by Andy Sennett. You can find a link to them at our own website, www.pcjmedia.com, and you'll see a link listed at the bottom of the page.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. North Korean leader Kim Jong-il died on December 17th. It was not until the 19th that the Korean news agency announced his death. His youngest son, Kim Jong-un, said to be 28 or 29 years old, has taken over as leader of the Democratic Republic of Korea, one of the world's most reclusive states. Since then, the North Korean propaganda machine has been working overtime. Keith now joins us for a closer look. When was the announcement of the death of Kim Jong-il, and how was it done? And was it different from when his father, Kim Il-sung, died?
Well, the announcement itself happened on December the 19th at probably after 3 hours GMT, or around that time. Kim Jong-il himself died on the 17th, and it took them a couple of days to probably come out with the official party line, that's the Workers' Party of North Korea, to decide what they are going to say. When I heard the announcement, I was just in the process of listening to the news on Radio Australia, and partway through the bulletin, you can hear some paper being handed to the announcer, and the announcer just said, we have unconfirmed reports that Kim Jong-il has died. We'll have more later on in the program. And that was it. When I heard that, I went to the website for CNN and BBC, and they still hadn't put it up yet. It was only until about 20 minutes later. The difference, I think, between the death of Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung, in 1994 is really not that much. I think the only big difference was the time delay. Now, in 1994, I remember it very well because I was in Cuba. We received a notice that came over the wire services that Kim Il-sung had died. But when you look closely to it, there was almost a five-day delay from when he actually died to when they actually made the announcement. That was probably the major difference.
The Central Committee of the Workers' Party of Korea, the Central Military Commission of the Party, and the National Defense Commission, the Presidium of the Supreme People's Assembly, and the Cabinet of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea inform you with deepest grief that the great leader Kim Jong-il, General Secretary of the Workers' Party of Korea, chairman of the National Defense Commission of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and supreme commander of the Korean People's Army, passed away from a sudden attack of illness on the road of field guidance at 8 hours 40 minutes on December 17th, 2011.
Why do you think that they were able to do it sooner with Kim Jong-il?
Well, North Korea, as you know, has been in the spotlight quite a bit over the past 2 years. The first thing, of course, is when he named his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, who's estimated 28 or 29 years old, nobody knows for sure, as his successor. He's had some major health problems. There's the ongoing six-party talks over North Korea's nuclear program. There was the shelling of an island that belongs to South Korea. So I think what they wanted to do, because North Korea had been in the news so much, was to try to get this information out as soon as possible. And they did it. And they did it.
So it was just 2 days then that before they announced that the son of Kim Jong-il, that being Kim Jong-un, was the leader.
Yes, but you know, if you speak to a lot of, say, North Korea watchers, even though the announcement was made on the 19th and they said that he died on the 17th, people are speculating, well, you know, knowing North Korea and what it is and how they handle the process, they said it wouldn't be surprising if he had actually been dead for quite some time, but they just decided to choose that date to make the announcement. Nobody knows for sure, and I don't think that we will ever know for sure, but the speculation is there.
What is the new leader's title?
Ah, the titles. Yes, they love the titles. Kim Il-sung, the father and the founder of the DPRK. He is known as the Dear Leader, and he's also the Eternal President. His son, Kim Jong-il, was called the Great Leader and then the Supreme Leader. So he had two titles. His son, Kim Jong-un, is now known as the Supreme Commanding Leader of the DPRK.
I wonder how long before they start recycling.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So what was North Korean television showing?
On the day of the announcement, when the Central Broadcasting System in North Korea announced it on television, an announcer went on the air to read an official statement from the Korean Central News Agency. And all information that exits North Korea about North Korea goes through the same agency. It doesn't matter in what language it is. It's a carbon copy translation, so it's word per word. And what they showed is this woman announcing the death, announcing that, you know, when this happened, the sky changed color, and she was being very emotional on air. After the announcement was made, they went to play some revolutionary music, and then for about 24 to 48 hours, they were playing and showing video of people and their reaction of the crying in the street. Now, you know, when we hear about leaders around the world and news organizations, let's say, if a leader in the West dies, will say, you know, a lot of people were emotional and crying in the street. But this is nothing to what the North Koreans were showing. And I have a little excerpt right now to give you a sort of an audio illustration of what it was like. And there we heard, Paulette, you know, the outpouring of emotion that was taking place in North Korea with the death of Kim Jong-il. A lot of experts that I spoke to when this was going on said, you know, a lot of it is genuine, but at the same time, you need to take everything, as the old saying goes, with a grain of salt. A number of North Korea watchers, including Mike Shinoy, who worked as a CNN correspondent for more than 20 years, who's an expert on North Korea. He's now working as a professor, and they actually analyzed video that was coming out on satellite from North Korea, analyzing it frame per frame per frame. And they realized, you know, yes, a lot of it was genuine, but there was also a lot that was directed and made to seem cinematic, because when they analyzed the video, in each shot of the video, they can see reflections of what was going on behind the camera. And all the emotions were in front of the camera, but behind the camera, it looked like people were just talking. And then as the camera panned, all of a sudden people's emotions changed.
Now, this sounds to people in the West, this sounds very reminiscent of what we perceive to be propaganda in China, Cuba, the former USSR, and other states, former Eastern Bloc states. How is... Now, in conversations we had before, you said that North Korea is like that, but different. How?
Very different indeed. If you look at Chinese media from the Cultural Revolution, yes, of course, there was a lot of propaganda. If you look at media in the Soviet Union, especially during the height of the Cold War, yes, there was a lot of propaganda. You went to Ukraine in 1984. You remember what it was like in Ukraine in 1984. Mm-hmm. And Cuba as well. But very, very different. Different in the sense that in the Soviet Union, a lot of people that saw the propaganda either on television or in the cinemas knew that this was propaganda and nothing but rubbish. Mm-hmm. They knew it. Mm-hmm. You know, in China as well, I remember speaking to a colleague of mine that I worked with at China Radio International. We were covering this tourism convention together in Beijing, and North Korea had a stand, and they were showing videos from North Korea. And he said, you know, when he sees this stuff today happening in North Korea, he says it makes China look like a democratic country in the 1960s and 70s. Wow. That is the huge difference. If you compare it to Soviet propaganda in the 60s and 70s, it makes the Soviet Union seem like a democratic state, which it wasn't, but it makes it seem like it. That's how different it is.
Now, the Voice of Korea is the DPRK's international service. What is the difference between them and other shortwave services?
Well, other international broadcasters are extremely different. Even Radio Havana, Cuba, even the Voice of Vietnam, even China Radio International cannot compare to Voice of Korea. Voice of Korea is not just the voice of the government, but it's also the voice of who's ever in power. It was the voice of Kim Il-sung. It was the voice of Kim Jong-il. It's now the voice of Kim Jong-un. And basically what they call news is 20 minutes of what the leader did that day. Everything from congratulatory messages from these communist parties, like, for example, on the 20th of December, they read a message from the Communist Party of Canada with their deep condolences for the dear leader. They also had which was an odd one. It was from the Communist Party of New Zealand, which has approximately 5 members. And they read this statement for 5 minutes from the Communist Party of New Zealand, which has 5 members, saying they were showing their condolences to the Korean people for the passing of Kim Jong-il. So this is what their news is. And it doesn't matter, even if it's during their cultural segment, there is going to be something about, quote-unquote, the dear leader. If it's going to be about sports, there's going to be something about the dear leader. There's a funny clip that I have from a few years ago. It was from 2008, and it was about the North Korean Olympic team getting ready to go to Beijing for the 2008 Games. And in the sportscast, they actually said, and I quote, the great leader Kim Jong-il is a championship Olympic swimmer, but is unable to partake in the 2008 Games because of his serious duties at home at fighting Yankee imperialists.
Oh my goodness. Now, people in China and the former Soviet Union all were able to recognize the farcical nature of this propaganda. Do the North Korean people see through it too? Or do they actually believe it?
You know, that's a very difficult question. Unfortunately, and this is the sad thing, sadly, North Korea is so cut off from the rest of the world, unlike the Soviet Union and unlike China during the 60s and 70s. It is incredibly cut off. And there's generations of people, the only thing they know, the only thing they know is Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. They don't know anything else. And from an early age, this is what they're taught. Now, there of course, are people that know this is, you know, nonsense. And you hear that from defectors that managed to get out of North Korea. They say, there's actually a group of us in North Korea that know this is nonsense. But they'll say at the same time, there are people who really believe the stuff put out by the Korean Central News Agency and the Workers' Party.
Well, I think that was the case as well in former communist states. There is always an element of people that do actually believe it. Do the people in the DPRK have access to other foreign media, to the internet and Voice of America, BBC, World Service, and others?
Well, in the last few years, internet cafes have started popping up in Pyongyang. The difference is, okay, we call it the internet. We could connect to any website anywhere in the world, even to websites out of North Korea. In the DPRK, it's called internal net, which is a rough translation from Korea, from Korean. And basically, the internet in the North Korea only accesses North Korean websites. Only accesses North Korean websites. So people who do go to these internet cafes, and they're not cheap, they're very expensive, can only access something like 20 or 30 different websites, and they're all government propaganda websites or company websites that also have government propaganda.
So for the North Koreans who do find out what's going on in the rest of the world via foreign media, how do they do it?
Well, they do it by a very old technology, which is shortwave radio. In North Korea itself, unlike other countries, radio sets sold in North Korea are pre-tuned to government stations, and you also need to register the radio at the police station. In apartment buildings, they have radio and television fed in by cable, and the radio that's fed into apartment complexes in Pyongyang, you can't turn off. You can turn the volume down, but you can't turn it off. There are a number of North Koreans now that have been able to access shortwave radios. A number of groups in South Korea, what they will do is they will send these balloons facing North Korea that will contain a shortwave radio, some U.S. dollars, and information about South Korea and the rest of the world, including DVDs and everything. So they access them that way. The other way is by buying a shortwave radio on the black market that's smuggled in from China.
So is that what the U.S. dollars are for in the balloons?
The U.S. dollars is probably to, I think, more than anything, buy food on the black market. Because as we know, North Korea has been going through an extreme famine since, the mid-1990s.
So there is a black market that's thriving in North Korea.
There is a black market that's thriving in North Korea. Radios are a very hot commodity, especially the ones that are smuggled across the border from China into North Korea. The prices are completely outrageous. From defectors that spoke about this, said that, you know, let's say a shortwave radio in China would cost you maybe, say, $20 or $30. In North Korea, the same radio will cost you nearly $200.
Oh, wow.
And defectors have said, you know, people will do anything to try to raise the money, to bribe officials to get these radios across so they have access to information. It was recently discussed among some international broadcasters that target North Korea, saying, you know, well, how many people listen? The reality, of course, is we don't know. Nobody knows. And it was pretty much the same thing with the Soviet Union. The Voice of America for years had no idea how many people listened to the Voice of America and Radio Liberty in the Soviet Union. It wasn't until the collapse of the Soviet Union when they found out that their audience was in the millions. It was just in the millions. So North Korea is also in a similar kind of way. Now, the North Koreans do try to jam broadcasts from the Voice of America, BBC, Radio Free Asia, the South Korean freedom stations that target the North. But because of the fuel shortages that are in the DPRK, the jamming is not always effective. It is not always effective. There could be maybe 2 or 3 days of jamming, but then maybe after that, there's no more power at the jamming facility, so then there's no more jamming going on. And the jamming that the North Koreans are doing is not as efficient as, let's say, some other countries like China. The North Koreans are not very efficient at it. So the jamming can be heard outside of North Korea, but probably in North Korea itself. But like I said, we don't know for sure. It's probably not effective at all.
If you want more information on how to tune in to Voice of Korea and to get their full schedule, you'll find it listed at www.pcjmedia.com. You'll see a link in the latest news on the right-hand side of the page.
If you want more information about Media Network Plus, check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. Rwanda suffered a genocide in 1994. Even though the country is more stable than it was, many people are afraid that it could happen again. There are many people who are trying to help this so it won't. Radio is playing an important role in this, as we hear from Mary Kay Magstead.
Albert Rudatsimbura starts his day in the radio station he founded, walking past posters of Bob Marley, Che Guevara, and Jimi Hendrix. Rudatsimbura launched the station in the last days of 2004 with an old friend, who happens to be the brother-in-law of President Paul Kagame. The first thing on the air was a recording of Miles Davis playing So What from Kind of Blue. Rudatsimbura is a musician himself. He's also a returnee, having grown up in Belgium. When he settled in post-genocide Rwanda, he says, he realized something was missing from the radio scene.
Before we started, it was only the state radio. So that was the model. So we wanted just to show what it should be, you know, having funny breakfast shows, nice news. You must have noticed the kind of a post-genocide trauma, self-censorship culture. So we try to tell people that things could be different.
The station now has about 2 million listeners, a fifth of Rwanda's population. It offers music, call-in shows, debate, and news, and has about a dozen young reporters.
Bonjour. Morning.
They gather daily for an editorial meeting.
This is Contact FM Newsroom.
On this morning, one story in the works is about an illegal government detention center for street kids and vagrants.
Who decides when you can walk out? Aliko, based on what? When do they decide?
The reporter on the story is 25-year-old Richard Enda Yambaje. I ask what happens if he writes something the government doesn't like.
You never know what happens to you, but all you have to do as a journalist, I think, is to report the truth and, you know, wait to see what happens, whether the story makes an impact.
He says things are already better than when he started out in journalism 4 years ago. There are now dozens of Rwandan news media outlets, and the government is considering passing freedom of information legislation. Even so, critics of the government say press freedom in Rwanda remains seriously limited. Karina Tersakian is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was kicked out of Rwanda last year and now lives in London.
Everyone now knows the very negative role that the media played in the run-up to the genocide, and I think any responsible government would take measures to avoid that. But unfortunately, what has been happening instead is that this very vaguely defined offense of genocide ideology has been used to target government critics, not only journalists, but also opposition politicians and even ordinary Rwandans.
According to a Rwandan Senate report, about 200 people were convicted on the charge of genocide ideology from 2001 to 2006. Some were sentenced to years in prison. Rights groups have expressed concern about how many journalists have been convicted on this charge. Shaika Kanuma, editor of the newspaper Rwanda Focus, says such rights groups should take a closer look at what some of the convicted journalists have been writing.
You'll find someone writing that Hutus, actually it's their time to rise up. We are talking just 17 years after the genocide. And they'll go out and be publishing stuff that includes incitement.
President Paul Kagame makes no apologies for restricting speech he believes could reopen old wounds. At a recent news conference, he didn't try to hide his disdain for human rights groups that criticize his government.
We live in this world where some people think they're more right or even righteous than others.
Kagame's supporters say he has helped bring Rwanda back from the dead, that his government has restored social stability, built up the economy, and encouraged reconciliation, mostly. Others say he rules with too heavy a hand. Some ask why Kagame suspended two newspapers critical of him in the run-up to last year's national elections, why several journalists say they received threats or had been roughed up and had to flee the country. Vocal critic Charles Ingabira fled the country and was living in Uganda when he was shot dead last month coming out of a bar. Another journalist was killed in Rwanda last year. The government has denied involvement in both cases. Rights groups have called for independent investigations. Karina Tersakian of Human Rights Watch.
The climate for independent journalists in Rwanda right now is pretty bleak.
By independent, she means those who criticize the government. Rwanda Focus editor Shaika Kanuma argues, as rain pours down outside the pavilion we're in, that there is room for criticism, just not for lies.
I know that Paul Kagame is not a perfect president. He's not a perfect person. But when I see the terrible lies people tell, I know the kind of challenges we face as journalists in this country. But does that amount to abuse of human rights? Far from the case.
Back at Contact FM, owner Albert Rudatsimbura says journalism still has a long way to go in Rwanda, but he and his staff are trying. The station now has a weekend talk show called Crossfire. He says the show's free exchange of ideas can get pretty heated. I ask if there's also room in Rwanda for political satire, something like The Daily Show.
I think that it will take some time. You need the material to brew political satire. I mean, you need to see what politicians are doing. And most of the time, that is not public enough.
He says there's a funny YouTube video of a Rwandan comedian imitating President Kagame.
Same voice, same everything, you know. And I could see that some guys in the room were like, uh-oh, is this correct? Is this PC? You know, and even the president was there. And because he had a big laugh, I mean, everyone started to feel relaxed, you know. But I could see that some guys were stressed.
What Rwandans need, even more than satire, Rudatsimbura says, is to lose their submissive attitude toward power.
For people to understand that in a society like this, people are citizens. And in a society where you have citizens, we're not supposed to be treated as subjects. It's not a king there.
The call-in programs at Contact FM try to encourage people to speak up. And never are there more calls, Rudat Simbura says, than in the week each April when the station opens up the lines to commemorate the genocide. Survivors call in. A couple of perpetrators have called in to apologize.
Another case that we had also, we had a call. A couple of seconds, a guy saying, you know what? What we did in 94, we'll do it again.
The caller was referring to the genocide. His phone number was traced and he was arrested. Rudat Simbura says more young people are calling in these days and talking about the genocide as history. About half of Rwandans are too young to remember it. The government's policy to squelch hate speech and even mentions of ethnic divisions means they've grown up thinking of themselves not as Hutu or Tutsi, but as Rwandan. Whether that's come at too high a cost to free speech is open to debate. But a recent survey by the Prosperity Index in London found that most Rwandans feel they have adequate personal freedoms and trust their government. Less than a third said they trust each other.
That was Mary Kay Magstad from The World, a program jointly produced by the BBC World Service and Public Radio International.
St. Helena, located in the South Atlantic, is one of the most remote islands in the world. And it's one of the most expensive places in the world for internet use. Monthly service to the British-controlled island is nearly $230 US a month. And because it's by satellite and around 1,000 of the 4,000 residents on St. Helena have access to the internet, it's very slow. An initiative has been launched called Connect St. Helena. Christian van der Rolp is trying to gather support so that the small island can connect to the South Atlantic Express cable. He now joins us on the line from Germany.
Well, St. Helena, as you said, is in the middle of the South Atlantic. It's a very remote island, perhaps one of the most remote islands in the world. And the only connection to the outside world is a Royal Mail ship, the last one still on duty. It's the RMS St. Helena, which plies between Cape Town, South Africa, and St. Helena, which takes 5 days. And on top of that, this vessel also goes to Ascension Island, which is another 1,500 kilometers in the north west of St. Helena, and also goes to Tristan da Cunha, which is far south of St. Helena. So people have rarely the opportunity to catch the ship. And yeah, and they're only linked to the outside world in terms of communication is a satellite dish, which uses a transponder on Intelsat 707, a pretty old satellite, which was launched in 1996 with a lifetime of 11 years. And so it has already exceeded lifetime for 5 years. And yeah, the problem is that they are like 4,000 people, of which 1,000 are estimated to be internet users. And they all share this single satellite link, which has a downlink of 10 megabits and an uplink of 3.6 megabits. And as you can imagine, this is pretty slow, especially when you have to share it with so many people. And on top of that, they have frequent outages due to solar flares. And that's a pretty messy situation. And when I recently learned about the South Atlantic Express cable, it's a submarine communications cable, which will go from South Africa to Brazil, I realized that this cable could pass St. Helena and connect the island and provide broadband internet to the people.
Just a moment ago, you were talking about the internet speed by satellite.
I have in the past, on a couple of occasions, used the internet by satellite. And I can tell you, if it's one person, it's actually okay. But I can just imagine what it's like with 1,000 people. I mean, that must be even slower than an old dial-up modem.
Actually, it is. I mean, 10 megabits is not a little, but as soon as you have 1,000 people using it, of course, they won't use it all at once. But nevertheless, you have a very high load on this connection, you know. And that means there is no YouTube for these guys. There is no Skype, at least not with video and... yeah, it's problematic.
I also suspect that it's also very expensive on St. Helena to use the internet
Actually, it is coming from satellite. Actually, it is. Well, their biggest data plan is like 120 British pounds per month, and it gives you a downlink of I think 384 kilobits. And the data allowance is limited to approximately 3 gigabytes. And then each megabyte on top is built with somewhere 10-15 pence per megabyte. So it's pretty expensive. And if you consider their low income, the average income is 4,500 British pounds per year. This is prohibitively expensive for them.
Now, a moment ago, you were saying that you know, there's going to be an internet cable going from Brazil to South Africa. I mean, there's many parts of Africa where they're connecting in via the internet. Now, how far are they planning this cable? How far is it from St. Helena?
Well, I can't say definitely because the map they show on their website, the company which will build the cable is called E5 for other. Situated in Johannesburg, South Africa. They only have a quite a small map on their website, and I don't think it's 100% precise in geographical terms. So I can only give a rough estimate, and I think their cable would pass St. Helena in a distance of about 500 to 1,000 kilometers to the north, because I should mention that this cable will have an underwater branch which is going to Angola. So the cable comes from northern Brazil, has another underwater branch, and one of these branches going to Angola, the other to the south, to southern Africa, to Cape Town. And I did a bit of calculation and found out if you move that complete route to the south, then the cable would be extended by maybe 50 or maybe 100 kilometers, but it could pass St. Helena and land at the island.
Now here's something, because I'm just curious. The government in St. Helena, did they even think about requesting for something like this, or did you just start this as your own initiative?
They had talks last August with some of the parties involved, and they came to the conclusion that it would be prohibitively expensive. And the point was, they were told that they would have to buy an IRU, that's an irrevocable right of usage, which gives you the right for the whole lifetime of this cable, which is about 20 years, to use a certain... certain bandwidth. And I believe that price that they were given, was $50 million, is based on a whole wavelength.
Well, you just said $50 million?
$50 million U.S. dollars, yes.
That's even worth more than if you take 10 St. Helenas together. That would be more than the GDP of all 10 St. Helenas.
Actually, yeah, that's the point. But that price is based on an IRU for a whole wavelength, you know. And a wavelength on this cable will be 40 gigabits, you know. And 40 gigabits is just excessive for this small island. I mean, I haven't calculated it, but if you break this down by 1,000 users, that would be like 40 megabits per person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something like this. Yeah, so that would be excessive. And my idea is that they, instead of buying an IRU, which would be excessive in any case, they could lease it, you know. I mean, that's how submarine cables work. You know, when you build them, yeah, you're looking for some large carriers who buy IRUs, but then still most of them sublease capacity on their wavelengths. And in this case, E5, the company behind the cable, they actually offer on their website smaller circuits. So it's not necessary in my eyes to lease a whole wavelength on this cable. And the other point is there are technical benefits for E5 if they landed the cable. Now, these submarine optic fiber cables, they have repeaters. You need these to amplify the optical signal. They use erbium-doped fiber amplifiers. Mm-hmm. And they are called EDFA. And these amplifiers are required every 70 to 100 kilometers. These amplifiers, of course, need electric power. And therefore, you have a copper conductor in the cable, which usually is surrounding the optical fiber. And there you have direct current. And the problem is the longer the cable gets, the higher the voltage has to be. And there's somewhere a limit of about 14,000 volt. And if you exceed them, there's the danger of a flashover. So you can't go above 14,000 volts. And in previous projects, like the West African cable system, the WACS, they had to interrupt the circuit. And at one landing point, they had a new power feeding unit. So the cable is divided into two sections from the electricity point of view, no? Mm-hmm. And and this cable, the South Atlantic Express cable, will probably have a length of somewhere 9,000 kilometers, which comes very near to that what the West African cable system has. So I actually don't know how they intended to solve it without landing the cable somewhere en route, you know. But the point is they could land it at Santolina and feed in power again from there, you know. Mm-hmm. This is a technical benefit. Also, build new branches, new cables from Santolina, let's say to southern Brazil, and use it as a hub for future routes. Of course, there are underwater branches with which you can fork off the cable to other markets. But in that case, you have to fork off a whole fiber, and the number of fibers in the cable is limited. As far as I know, on the South Atlantic Express cable, they will have four fiber pairs, and so your options are limited. You can't build infinite branches. And if you land it at Santolina, you could build some hub there, and so there are technical and strategic benefits for the cable operator if they landed it at St. Helena.
That was Christian von der Rop from Connect St. Helena. For more information, you can check them out online at www.connectsthelena.org.
Paulette, do you know what the problem is with receiving the internet via satellite?
No.
Well, this past week, we have seen the worst solar activity since 2005, knocking down satellite communications and even HF communications. In fact, this past week, there were certain periods of time shortwave frequencies that were normally clear, you couldn't hear anything because of a geomagnetic storm. And it has happened on St. Helena when these storms happened that the island has no form of internet communication and even telephone communication.
Oh dear. That's drastic.
Quite messy. Mm-hmm. And speaking of propagation and, well, propagation's been lousy this week, what's going to be happening over the next 7 days? Here's Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from January 28th to February 3rd, 2012. The 10.7 centimeter flux will come first on January 28th and 29th, the 10.7 centimeter flux of 1/40. January 30th through February 2nd, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 1/35. On February 3rd, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 1/40. An A index of 5 from January 28th through February 1st. February 2nd and 3rd, an A index of 8. A KP index of 2 will be seen the entire week almost from January 28th through February 1st. February 2nd and 3rd will see a KP index of 3. The massive geomagnetic storm we recently experienced has had some after effects on the sun. We only see four sunspot groups, 1401, 1402, 1405, and 1408. We can expect a low level of solar activity with likely M-class flares until sunspot regions 1401 and 02 depart on January 28th. It's entirely possible for us to see quiet to unsettled conditions until February 2nd or 3rd as another geo-effective event becomes likely after that or around that date. Overall, propagation looks anywhere between minimal and hit or miss.
And thanks, Dan, for that propagation report. Now, Keith, I understand that you've got a trip planned to the United States. Fairly soon, you're going to be heading to the Winter Shortwave Listener Fest.
That's right, Paulette. I will be heading to Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. I'll be arriving there on the 29th of February and will be staying there until March 4th for the SWL Fest, or the Winter Shortwave Listeners Fest, which takes place once a year, usually at the beginning of March. This year is a special festival because it is the 25th anniversary. Now, most people know that it took place in Culpsville for 23 years. Well, last year and this year it's taking place in Plymouth Meeting, like I said, and it's taking place at the Doubletree Guest Suites in Plymouth Meeting. There is a website you can check out, which is www.swlfest.com. That's www.swlfest.com, and it has all the information on how to book your room at the hotel. There is a special rate, by the way, for people attending the festival, and it also has the information on how to register to attend the SWL Fest. The full registration is only $80, which includes the meals. They have ones 3 days no meals, 1 day no meals, and everything else. But just go to the website www.swlfest.com, and I will be there with bells on. Well, hopefully bells, but I don't think they'll be ringing because I'll probably be a little bit too jet lagged.
I don't even want to think about bells and things like that on you, Keith.
Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of the monthly edition of the program. If you want to listen to this program again, as well as the weekly 30-minute edition, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. You'll also find a full schedule for the weekly edition, which airs on the World Radio Network, Sirius XM, Sky Digital, and to Europe in Digital Radio Mondiale, or DRM, and also to the Caribbean, Latin America, and North America on 9,955 kilohertz, as well as on great partner stations everywhere. And that's the weekly edition of the program. And of course, you can contact us anytime, Paulette. What is our email address?
mnp@pcjmedia.com.
I don't know about you, Paulette, but today was one of those shows where everything seemed to go wrong behind the microphone. Luckily, listeners won't be put through that torment.
That's the good thing about editing equipment, yes.
Yes, but the bad thing, of course, is the clips will stay around for a long time, and you never know when I'll dig them up to embarrass ourselves.
No doubt, no doubt.
Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. So for me, Keith Parent in Taipei, Taiwan.
And me, Paulette Macquarie in Vancouver, Canada.
We'll see you all again very, very soon. 73s to you all and 88s to the ladies.